Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Klum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome to episode number 86 of The Coaching Staff. Back with me is my co-host, Mr. Tony D. Viss. Mr. Viss, how are you this fine, beautiful, now that the rain has finally blown through Monday evening?
I'm doing all right. That's the thing lately is, you know, a lot of rain recently, but, you know, we had been in a severe drought, so I think it's helped get us out of that. So that's been good. I'm sure the farmers are happy. It's opening day for the high school baseball season here in Iowa. Cougars already got a game in, 1-7-4 in the opening game of the doubleheader. So yeah, I can't complain. How are things in Nebraska?
It's fine. We kind of had 24 hours worth of rain here. We're recording on Monday evening, 24 hours worth of rain. And it's reminded me that I need to clean my gutters out. So the next day or two, I hate that. Home ownership is great, but that's one job I really don't like, being a homeowner. And then I'm kind of looking up. I got this big maple tree in my front lawn. I'm going to have to trim some branches here. And just, you know, adulting is not fun sometimes, Tony. It's just not fun. So, but no, everything's doing well. We only got a couple days left before school gets out. So we are all good. So episode 86, Tony, I've got three wide receivers.
Whew. I would start with Hines Ward.
That's one.
And then I'm in trouble.
Both of these guys at one time, I believe, I know one did for sure, and I'm very confident of the other one, played for the Green Bay Packers.
I think Greg Jennings was 85, so I don't think it's him.
Yes, they both did.
Okay. Shoot. It's close, but I'm not getting them.
We may have had this guy before as well, one of them. Because he was a Buffalo Bill and a Green Bay Packer.
So Andre Reed?
Nope.
No? No, it wouldn't be Steve Tasker.
No.
BB?
Nope.
Hmm.
You got one more left to go.
I'm stumped on this one.
All right. James Lofton.
Ah, makes sense.
Yeah. And Antonio Freeman.
That was the one I was probably closer to. I'm not going to pretend that I was close with James Lofton, but Antonio Freeman, I was close. I just couldn't get the name.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. So those were our number 86s, and episode 86 brings us to the topic of the mid-range game and sharing the ball. Tony, this was when I texted you earlier today, I kind of said, hey, what do you want to talk about? I kind of didn't have anything really in mind, and you threw this out there. What were what are you kind of thinking here with this? Why was this the topic du jour, not the soup du jour, the topic du jour of the day?
Sharing the ball just kind of came down. I don't know if you caught any of the press conference after the Nuggets and Timberwolves last night, but they were talking to Aaron Gordon, and you know, they were asking him as far as why he plays the way he plays, you know, unselfishly shares the ball. About that time, here comes Jokic walking in. He goes, if this dude right here, three-time MVP, arguably the best player in the world right now, is doing it, then why in the world wouldn't I? Mm-hmm. And so that kind of was that side of things. And then the mid-range game, you know, is one of those things where I think people get into this thought process of, hey, it's either got to be a three or a layup. And don't get me wrong, those are good shots.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what are you going to do if there's somebody in that lane that's a really, really good rim protector like a Rudy Gobert, or if they're running you off the three-point line? You got to figure something out. And so the mid-range game, not only should it be a part of your regular arsenal, but a lot of times, to be honest with you as well, like at the end of a quarter, end of a half, end of the game shot, the mid-range game, more times than not, seems like that's everybody's choice, if you will. That's kind of what they go to. And how many of those mid-range games have mid-range pull-ups, I'm sorry, have won some games.
Yeah. I think kind of what you said there, Tony, about the mid-range game is, and this was the first thing on my list, especially as high school coaches, yeah, just take good shots. You know, good shots for your players. And if it's a 15-footer, but it's a good shot for that kid, you can't sit there and overanalyze it. I mean, you gotta play the hand that you're dealt. And now if you're Bill Self at Kansas or wherever, if you're a college coach and you can recruit and you have the time to, develop your kids into that, or you have a long-standing youth system that this is what we're going to really emphasize, then you have the ability to do that. But I agree with you, Tony, that, I understand the analytics of it. I get the math equation. At the same time, we can't just develop those players to exactly what we want or go out and get different players in most situations. And so I think when we talk about the mid-range game, I think just the most important thing they emphasize to your team is taking really, really good shots. Now, with any shot, with any skill, whether we're talking about basketball or another sport or another activity, a piano player, whatever it may be, you've got to have the reps. And if you've got a player that needs the reps, they've got to go out and get the reps. If they're only able to shoot it from 6-7 feet away, they've got to go in, and they're not going to go from 6 or 7 feet to 19.9. Let's go from 6 or 7 to 12 to 14, and then let's move it out to 17. I kind of always used to tell my kids, by next season, so if as a freshman, you can shoot it pretty consistently from 15 feet, that's fine. By your sophomore year, take a step back. Now you're at 18 feet, and and then by your junior year, now you're going to be a consistent 3-point shooter, and that's kind of the road to development that we would use. But you got to get those reps in, and whatever your offensive tool chest is, whatever is in your bag, as the kids say these days. Listen to how hip my lingo is, Tony. You've got to have those reps to do it. And so I think that's a big thing with any sort of skill development in that regard.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that, too, with younger kids, it's a strength thing. You know, as they get stronger, as they get in the weight room, as they mature, then they're going to increase their range. And so I think that's a big part of it as well, is reps, strength. And it's one of those things where as you're getting stronger, as you're growing, as you're getting more mature, it's one of those things where you've really got to make sure that you're shooting. And so that way you understand, how hard you have to shoot it, what your fundamentals are, what your focus is, and different things like that. And so that's a big part of it as well. And the more you can become adept at what we would identify as the three levels, rim, mid-range, 3-point, the more opportunity you're going to have to be on the floor and the more points you're going to score as you become more adept at each of those and become confident and comfortable in those areas.
Mm-hmm. What else you got, buddy?
When you take a look at the sharing it, and this is kind of going a little bit hand in hand with the two of them, is the fact that with sharing the ball is just so very, very important. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. The more you add to your tool belt, your bag, like you mentioned earlier, the better off you're going to be. I think that's one of the things that makes Jokic so impressive, is the fact that he scores, pretty much at will. He's almost an unguardable player. But the other thing is, when you begin to run different guys at him, he's able to find them. I mean, Gordon was 9 for 9. How many, early on in the game, I don't know where he ended up overall.
I think he finished 10 or 11, 10 for 11 or 11 for 12, something like that.
But how many of those were assisted by Jokic? And when you go back and take a look, when Denver, was a little bit in trouble in those first two games, when Minnesota kind of had them on the ropes, if you will, they were playing Gobert in that free safety position, and Jokic tries to throw the lob to Gordon, and Gobert is there to pick it off. And then all of a sudden, you get into a game of adjustments, and Mike Malone, I don't know if he's the best right now. Spoelstra might have something to say about that, but he's definitely in the top 3 to 5 coaches in the NBA, and he made some adjustments. And now all of a sudden, Gobert kind of looks like he did a few years ago when they were playing Utah, and Utah went 5 out. he's looking like a liability. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that culture of sharing the ball, when your superstar shares the ball and it sets that culture, it sets that standard that everybody's here to do it. You find guys like an Aaron Gordon who, be honest with you, before he was traded to the Nuggets, was kind of a lost guy. And now all of a sudden, he is an indispensable part of this Nuggets machine and just huge. I mean, in that dunker position, he has found a perfect fit for himself there in Denver. But the willingness to pass the ball and to take our shot, and that kind of goes back to mentality. A lot of times I think people focus on my shot or their shot or whatever the case may be. But if you can get into it where it's our shot and you're taking a good shot, that's what's good for the team. Again, that aids the team, that builds the team, and then also continues to improve the team's chemistry. And not only you're a connected team on the offensive end, but a lot of times that connectivity will also bleed over into the defensive end.
You know, I think that, you know, you want to celebrate sharing the ball, Tony. It is something that in your practices, in your games, that you celebrate it. And when your best player is a selfless player, and you say, you know, the phrase I would use, Tony, basically the same thing, but just a different way to say it, you know, get the shot we want. You know, not get the shot you want or the shot they want. Get the shot we want. Whatever is a good shot for whatever team I was coaching at the time. And so get the shot that we want. But then, you know, like I said, celebrate it. It becomes infectious. You think of Larry Bird and how his passing was infectious. Magic Johnson, Steve Nash, John Stockton. You know, and I think Jokic is in that same class of just selfless players. And because they sell, you know, they do it. You remember, back in the day, Tony, when, you know, but you think of the All-Star games when we were kids, when Isaiah and Magic would really get it cooking in the All-Star game and the passing that we would see, and everybody is trying to kind of one up each other, for lack of a better way of saying it, because it does become that infectious thing. And I think it's really important that you celebrate it. I think another way that you celebrate it and that you emphasize it is through film, whether it's your film or it's other films. You know, we, before this season, we spent a few minutes breaking down, it's a documentary called about the 2014, Spurs, the one that demolished the Heat in the finals there. And it's called The Beautiful Game or something like that. And just, we talked about that, you know, again, Jokic, and just, you know, hey, look at, you don't have to be a point guard to be a great distributor and a sharer of the ball, but you could be a 7-foot post player, you know, quote unquote post player. You know, Caitlin Clark, finding her teammates. You know, everybody gets caught up in the 3-point shooting and all that other stuff, but she averaged 9 assists a game, I think, this year, something like that. You know, she was so responsible for so much scoring. And so I think that there's so many different ways that you can celebrate it, that you can show it, you can use film, and you can make that part of your team's culture in the same way that you can make all the other things that we talk about, the pillars of culture. If we're selfless players, that is a massively important part to any sort of successful team.
And I think it's one of those things, too, where if your team shares the ball, one of the things that's really, really hard to guard is players moving without the ball. And if you know that if you cut and you're open, your teammate's going to find you, mm-hmm. You become really, really tough offensively. And then, you know, Marty, you brought up Caitlin Clark, and like you said, known for the logo 3. But I still think the most impressive thing about her is her passing. You know, you mentioned 9 assists, and I'm not trying to be mean and put down any of the Iowa players, because Kate Martin obviously made a WNBA roster. Yeah. But it wasn't like she was playing with 4- and 5-star players.
Correct.
She made some players look very, very good around her, and she would reward players who would run the floor. And I think that really helped the Iowa culture offensively, especially. And so I just think that's something, like you said, if it's something that is emphasized by the leader, it becomes important to those around the leader. And one of the things I think that is really helpful in that is we call them lasers. I'm trying to remember, I think it was Nate Oakland who I stole that from. But when somebody makes a great pass to you and you score, you immediately turn around and you point at them. And I think that laser, if you will, really kind of builds that too. And the next thing you know, it just becomes contagious. And when you feel appreciated by your teammates, like anything, if I feel appreciated at work, I'm going to work harder. If I feel appreciated by my teammates because they recognize my passing, it just becomes contagious. And pretty soon it's just more and more people. And we're, you know, leading the conference or whatever it may be, an assist. And that's just a fun style of basketball to watch. And I think that's what the fans want to watch. One of the harder style of basketball to watch is the incessant clear outs where you allow somebody to play one-on-one.
Yeah. Well, I think that you're right there, Tony. You know, you work harder and you cut harder and you move harder and you play better defense when you know that if you cut hard, if you do this, you're going to get the ball. You're going to get a chance to score, you know? And I think that's just an invaluable thing that you could have with your team. I also thought of something here when you talked about lasers and how you reward your, or you talk about, you know, pointing out lasers or whatever here. I got this for you.
I have one simple request, and that is to have sharks with freaking laser beams in their heads.
That's outstanding.
It's what I do. It's what I do. When my wife hears that, she's just going to shake her head and go, why have I been with this man for 26 years? You know?
Because of that very reason. Yeah, who else would have been able to find that?
Exactly. So, coaches, it is official. October 12th and 13th, Saturday and Sunday, October 12th and 13th, 2024, will be our first annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Retreat. It is going to be over 24 hours of just basketball coaching and getting yourself primed and ready for the upcoming season. We're going to do a lot of different things. Coach Flannery and the staff at Creighton University have been gracious enough to allow us to come in and watch them practice that day. We're going to have roundtable sessions with coaches that you're attending the clinic with, which is one of the best aspects of any A Pen and a Napkin event. We're going to have a full timeout situation score group discussion with the coaches that are attending, as well as coaches social, and then, of course, guest speakers. We got some great coaches lined up right now. We're probably going to be adding a couple of more here. It is going to be a great, great weekend here in Omaha. We'll be staying at the Holiday Inn Express at 87th and West Dodge Road here in Omaha, and it is really, really affordable. $200 for the weekend, and that includes food, that includes your lodging at the hotel, drinks, everything that goes into it. It is going to be included in that $200 for well over 24 hours worth of activities. If you're a commuter, if you're living in the Omaha area and you want to join in, but you don't want to stay at the hotel, it's $125. Think of that. That's literally $5-6 an hour for an entire weekend of becoming a better coach. So coaches, I encourage you to sign up as soon as you can for the first annual A Pen and a Napkin Fall Coaches Retreat. How do you teach? What are some other ways you could teach sharing the ball, Tony?
I think in terms of like your shooting drills and stuff like that, you know, one of the things that we'll do is we'll put four around the arc and then we'll get the ball moving. And, you know, you put three defenders out there and you swing it to the open player and you take that take that open three, or you take that open corner jumper or whatever it may be. But I think you do that where you put some advantage shooting in place. And so they work on moving the ball and finding that player. But if you watch the NBA, that's pretty much the NBA's gig, is where they penetrate on the baseline, whether they kind of do that corner drift or they kick out to the diagonal. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's just about moving the ball and finding the open player. And so if you can put advantage shooting drills in place, I really think that helps. But I go back to what you're talking about. I think film's big. highlighting that. And I think if you can just build in that camaraderie where it's recognized and it is not only recognized, but it's, you know, pointed out just in terms of like rewarded for doing it. Mm-hmm. I think that's another step that goes a little bit further there as well.
You know, you were talking about those advantage shooting drills, and a lot of those come off the pass. Obviously, we're talking about sharing the ball. I think it's so important that we emphasize passing. It's such, I mean, you know, it's such an undertaught skill. But two out of every three touches ends with a pass. So why? And again, guilty as charged. Like, we emphasized it a lot in the sense of, hey, on time, on target, receive it well, you know, so forth and so on. But, you know, we probably didn't do enough pure passing drills. And there's not enough time to, in the day to do everything that you want to do with every single skill, with every single one of your players. I understand that. But, you know, it's important that when you're talking about that, it's just, it doesn't have to be no look, dipsy-doo, dunkaroo, behind the back, you know, type of stuff. You're thinking Magic Johnson leading the Showtime Lakers or anything like that. You know, Jokic is not what you would call a fancy passer, and I'm using air quotes there, Tony. But it's just simple passes hitting the open person on time and on target. And I really think that emphasizing that passing is not taught enough. I also think that, and I'm reading a book here in preparation for a pod coming up in a couple of weeks here, shameless plug, but constraints. Is the phrase that's used in the book. And, you know, we used to just call them limitations or, you know, different rules for the drill, whatever you want to call it. But the new buzzword is constraints. So you're doing 3-on-3, and you're not just going to have them play 3-on-3, but you put certain limitations or constraints to emphasize sharing the ball. So, you know, one of the big things, and this, you know, goes back to watching 1,000 hours of Don Meyer, but, you know, limiting dribbles was always a big one for us. Hey, you can only dribble it once or twice every time you touch it, because you've got to work to get open, you've got to share, you've got to cut, you've got to slide, you've got to move. Or kind of the opposite, but in a different way. Hey, you've got to get a paint touch before you score. You know, before you can put a shot up, somebody's got to get a paint touch, or you got to get two paint touches, or whatever it may be. Or maybe you say, hey, Billy can't score, but Billy's got to touch it before you score. You know, Billy's got to get a touch, or Billy's got to touch it twice before your team can shoot the shot, or whatever type. There's a million different combinations of constraints that you can put into place to help with sharing the basketball. But in your small-sided games, those are great things to do. Put a shot clock up. You know, hey, you've got 12 seconds to score, but you've got to pass it at least four times before you get a shot up. But you also got to get a shot up within 12 seconds, or different things like that, just to emphasize movement, cutting hard, slashing, all those different things to get your team to move and share the ball. Because I think a lot of times, Tony, with the kind of the AAU emphasis, and it's nothing against AAU. There's a lot of good AAU coaches out there, and they get their teams to play the game the right way. But there is a lot of you are tending to see, like you were talking about, the standing and watching while Billy or Betty is doing this and this and this. Well, in order to share it really well, you've also got to get some movement off the ball. Kind of the lost art of moving without the ball, crack backing, relocating, whatever term you want to use. And so I think those are ways that, you know, I don't know if our kids move as well without the ball as maybe we once did, based on those type of things as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, the one thing I was thinking of, like when you scrimmage, you know, you can give them an extra point or two if their bucket comes off the assist. Mm-hmm. That would be a way to do that as well. And then sometimes what you can do, depending upon, you know, if you're a 5-out, 4-out, 1-in, whatever, but you can have, if you feed the post, that split post action that's kind of all the rage in the NBA,
yep,
you can do some of that type of stuff with them too, and that'll get a little bit more where you build in that movement that everybody kind of has an idea of what's going to happen if the ball gets touched in the post area. So mm-hmm. I think that would be something that you could put in there as well that might help to give them a clue as to what's going to happen. And also guide them in terms of, you know, the type of things to expect once the ball does go into the post.
That's about all I had for the mid-range or for the sharing the ball, Tony. Did you have anything with that? I had a couple more things I wanted to talk about with the mid-range, but do you have anything else on sharing the ball?
I'm good on sharing it. Okay. I would be interested to let y'all let you go first on this next part with the going back to the mid-range.
Yeah. You know, kind of, you know, a lot of times we associate mid-range with off the bounce and attacking your player. I think it's, to me, it's a lot of cones and chairs. Again, kind of a little bit of a preview of a pod we're going to have here in a couple of weeks. You know, there's a lot of us that want to have that free-flowing, positionless basketball. But in order to do that, you've also got to have those base skills. And kind of the comparison I'm making here is, you know, jazz music, when you get that improv going and everything is feeling great, it's awesome. But you also got to master the scales before you're able to do that improvisation type of stuff. And so I think with that mid-range game, you've got to really master the cones and the chairs and do a lot of things with that. And mixing in your small-sided games and your constraints on top with that. But the cones and chairs and the biggest thing and the reason why shooting off the bounce is more difficult is your balance. And getting your players to reestablish their balance, their shoulders forward, they're getting their shoulders square, their footwork lined up the way that it needs to be. All those different things, that just comes with reps and reps and reps. And I think that's, if you're looking at improving that mid-range game and having your players make plays off the bounce and hitting those shots from 10, 12, whether it's a floater, whether it's an old-school pure pull-up J, it's those cones or it's the chairs that you're working with there.
Yeah, I think that's key. And then you can do some other stuff with that, the cones and the chairs as well, is you can teach them how to read the defense. And so, you know, some of that will help too and lead to whether you curl that cut a little bit rather than maybe flaring it, just so that you can learn to teach them how to read it. And once they get down the stuff with the cones and chairs, then you can put people out there, make it a little bit more live, and you can kind of dictate how the defense is going to cover it. And then hopefully it becomes like second nature. And then all of a sudden you do make it live and you don't know what the defense is going to do. And then you have to rely on that basketball IQ. But I think those are all really good things out of that mid-range game as well.
I had two more things with that, Tony. You want me to keep going or?
Yeah, you're on a roll.
All right. I think off of that, you're not going to have the bag. Most kids are not going to have the bag. There's my hip lingo again, Tony. But what's a go-to move that your player can have, and what's a counter off of that? You know, so, hey, this player is really, really strong at a good shot fake, two hard dribbles left and pulling up and shooting it off the glass from either side. Okay, so that's their move, and then what's the counter? You know, shot fake, two hard dribbles with their left, crossover into a floater, you know, and if you can just, it's kind of the old school post, you know, what's your move, what's your counter, and then everything else is gravy. But if you can get that, and I think the same thing kind of goes with the old school mid-range off the bounce game. What are you really, really good at off the bounce? Give me one good thing that you're really, really good at there. And then what's a good counter that you have to that? And then everything else, it's just gravy. It's just gravy at that point. So that was another thought.
Yeah, one of those things where, you know, kids are going to come in with a strength, like you're talking about, what's your go-to? And then, like you mentioned, give them a counter. And then once they're ready, kind of kick those training wheels off and then look to add a move or two or three, depending upon their level and development and stuff like that. But I think those are all really, really good. Because I think a lot of times what happens when you get with a trainer or whoever it may be, you know, you want to do, you know, dribble, 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 and just, you know, and those dribble moves, I don't know, it just doesn't equate well. And going back to kind of that sharing the ball thing, you know, I'm pretty simplistic in the fact that, hey, you're going to get it. you've got about a half second to make a decision, whether that's shoot it, put it on the bounce, pull it up, or move it. I don't think we need to get into the 5, 10, 15 dribble combination stuff that's really hard to play with. And so, you know, I think the more we can keep it simple and give them a few different reads here and there, I think the better off they're going to be. But some of the things that they get into, I mean, you're not going to run across too many. They're going to have a LeBron James bag and going to have, you know, the Anthony Edwards and different things like that. And so I think the more you can simplify it for them and get really, really good at one, two, maybe three or four things, the better off they're going to be.
Mm-hmm. I got one more thing, Tony. You mind if I throw it out there?
Let's do it.
All right. If a player is not an offensive player, especially at the high school level, and let's just be honest, most of our teams are going to have a minimum of one and probably two or three legitimate, not strong links at the very least in their lineups. And if you got five kids on the floor that can score at the high school level, you're going to be really, really good. I mean, you know, Tony and I could come in there and coach that team and you'd still be pretty good, you know, so
at least 500.
But if a player doesn't have a great range, or even if they don't have a mid range, what else can the player bring to the table to help you win? And there are so many other things, especially at the high school level, that you have to find with a player that might not have great shooting range or even a mid range game. But what can they do to help you win? You know, I had a player on a team, not very big. She's only about 5'7" ish. And she really couldn't shoot it from anywhere outside 4 or 5 feet. You know, she's adequate free throw shooter, but not great, 55, 60%. But she was scrappy. She played her tail off, did a lot of really, really good things, just and got better as she got older, without a doubt. She put in the work. But we had to play her because she brought so many other things to the table with her work ethic, winning, you know, she made 50-50s, 70-30s, things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you can't have, for the most part, at the high school level, you're not going to have that perfect team. So you've got to find a way to have those players who might not have a whole lot of range to their shooting, have them find what is a way that you can design your offensive system to have that player help you win games, because you're gonna have kids like that more often than not. So that's my last point there, Tony.
Yeah, and there are a variety of ways, Marty, that you can do that. You know, one of the big things that you can find there is that they can set screens. You know, because if their defender all the time is in help, you know, they can go and set ball screens, and that is really, really effective. The other thing, movement without the ball, again, kind of being in that dunker spot. You know, I'm guessing that they're out there. Like you said, they might do some other things well, whether that's help defense, rebound, whatever the case may be. And I'm guessing they can probably make a 2-3-4 foot shot out of that dunker position off penetration. Mm-hmm. And different things there. And then the other thing too is that if they're not being guarded closely, you can run them kind of in that high post area, 15, 18 feet out.
Yeah.
And not that you're really looking to shoot it there with them,
yep,
but they can pass it. And the other thing that's really, really effective as well is dribble handoffs.
Yeah.
And so if they go and dribble it at a player and kind of do that handoff and set the screen off the handoff, that can also be super effective as well. So yeah, there's a variety of ways you can deploy them. But like you said, you know, I've run across some teams that I've coached against that had 4 or 5 Division I players on the floor, and everybody can score it. And those teams are a nightmare and really, really hard to guard, almost impossible to guard. But yes, I've also had teams and coached against teams where the kid struggled to score. And so we would play one-man zone. We would not guard them and different things like that. And if the coach didn't utilize them in some effective ways, we really limited their effectiveness on the offensive end.
Mm-hmm. A Pen and a Napkin University videos are just another way that a pen and a napkin can help you become a better coach. Our university video library is constantly expanding, with topics ranging from interviewing for a job to full court defense to 25 universal truths about coaching. Our university videos will help you round out your skill set as a coach and help you hone your craft. Videos are $10 a piece, with bundling options available. To order, you can DM me on Twitter, send me an email at apenandanapkin@gmail.com or order from our website, apenandanapkin.com. Be sure to check out the A Pen and a Napkin video library. Well, Tony, you know whose effectiveness is never limited by anything.
Obviously, Europe.
You know, Tony, I just got done reading a book. I'm kind of a true crime buff. Have I ever told you that?
No, I don't think so.
And I was reading about this guy. He's called the Red Ripper. And I can't pronounce his Russian name or whatever. But he was like one of the world's most notorious serial killers in the 1980s. I don't know why I'm sharing with this you. I heard the foreign, kind of the Eastern European lingo there, and I don't know. I finished the book last night, and I guess I just wanted to share that with you. So, moving on. I don't know why I said that. It just popped into my head. So,
it works. Now, are we ready for trivia?
I'm ready for trivia now. As long as you're talking about Russian serial killers,
I'm ready to do Russian serial killers. That'll be your topic here. Obviously, the basketball world has a variety of things going on, from the NBA draft to the WNBA season getting ready to kick off. But the one thing that probably shook the basketball world, at least on the women's side of things today, was longtime Iowa coach Lisa Bluter retired today.
Yep.
And was replaced by her longtime assistant, Jan Jensen. I think Jan had been with her as the associate head coach at Iowa. I believe she had been the associate head coach for 20 years and now slides over and is the head coach, and I think it'll be a seamless transition. But here is my trivia question. Who did Lisa Bluter succeed as the head coach of Iowa 2 decades plus ago?
Shameless plug. She said something about it when I interviewed her a couple of years ago. Because she said she'd been at Drake for 5 years, she didn't get the job, and she was frustrated at the time, but it turned out the best thing for her. She needed another, 4 or 5 years at Drake to really get her ready for the Iowa job. So there's the whole backstory with everything. It was on podcast number whatever it was. Tony, you're killing me. You know what? I got nothing. You're going to say the name and I'm going to know it. But I don't got it.
This lady was an assistant under C. Vivian when C. Vivian left and went to Rutgers. And her name is Angie Lee.
That's right. That's right. And she was there for about four or five years.
Yep. And then the crazy thing, I mean, she had recruited fairly well, but obviously it wasn't at the level of what was with Vivian. Mm-hmm. And the very first year that Lisa came in, they won the conference championship.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like what Tom Davis did with George Raveling's players when he came in mm-hmm. in 87-ish or whatever it was. So, that's a good one, Tony. Yeah, I knew, like I said, I knew the whole backstory. I knew everything other than what the name was. And so there it is. You win, Tony. You win.
About time I win some.
Well, I think even Mel Allen would say.
How about that?
And that's good for Tony right there. So let's dive right into it. We're recording this Monday night. Coach Bluter just announced her resignation today. Tony, you're on the eastern side of Iowa. Had there been rumors, innuendos? It was
completely out of the blue. Yeah, because some people were saying that if it had been Kirk Ferentz or Fran McCaffrey, they would have been less surprised than what it was with Coach Bluter. Mm-hmm. And others after having seen it taking place were like, yeah, just it made sense. Going out with Caitlin Clark, the program's in a much better position, obviously, than when she inherited it. Jan has pretty much recruited, been one of the lead, if not the lead recruiter for every one of them coming in there. And it just, it makes sense. Like what we were talking about earlier, I think that she'll need a veteran assistant. That would be my, if she was looking for my advice, which I'm sure she's not, but if she's looking at my advice, that would be what I would recommend for, is to get her an experienced assistant that can help her with some of that game management stuff. Cause she's known as the post whisperer. She's one of the best recruiters out there. Just a very genuine, just a super, super nice person. And she's got good people there with Tania Davis and Raina Harmon, as well as Abby Stamp. But they need someone to step into that spot and be, if not her lead assistant, but definitely be somebody that can help out with that side of things.
Well, Tony, she called me to get your number. I just didn't get a chance to send it to you.
Yeah.
Sorry, Jan, you're hearing this here. But I think it's a logical move in the sense of replacing Coach Bluder with Jan Jensen. She has been there every step of the way. She played for Coach Bluder at Drake, was her assistant for for a while at Drake, and then obviously been there every step of the way at Iowa. I think it's a really, really positive move in that regard. I think it is surprising for Coach Bluder, but at the same time, it's not. I think if you drill down on it, I mean, what more could you do at this point? You could, to a degree, only go backwards, and not backwards, but is the program going to be able to achieve those heights? And she's 63 years old. I think she'll be 64 she would have been 64 when the season would have started. How much energy does she have left to climb that ladder again and again and again? And now, you know how it works, Tony. Once you reach this level, people get crazy and they believe that should be the way it is every year. And at very few places, it's like that every year. I'm kind of in the first reactionary phase, and having gone through this a little bit with myself in my career, we both went through it, Tony, where, we just kind of get to that point where it's just like, man, I just don't have that thing that you need to have, and maybe that's where Coach Bluder was at. I'm not really sure, but
it sounded like she had gone on vacation with her husband and just knew as they got coming back that she didn't have the juice, if you will, to keep doing it. Like you mentioned, 63 years old. The one thing I will say that Iowa, I feel like, has done a pretty good job on is they've kind of have done a really nice job of playing off the Caitlin Clark and all that she brought, the attention, being in the spotlight, sure, the celebrities and things like that. I think they've recruited very, very well. It'll be interesting to see, because I think it's this year's junior class. They're in on some pretty good kids there. If they can hit on all of them, it would be the greatest recruiting class Iowa's ever brought in, bar none. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to get all of them, but they've done a pretty good job with this thing. And I think it's a program that's set up to have success. But the one thing I would kind of remind out there, I mean, obviously Vivian did a great job getting them to the Final Four, and Lisa has kind of built upon that, taking them to the last two national championship games. I don't know if that's something that is sustainable in Iowa, and I'm not knocking Iowa. You just get the 4 and 5 star players like the, Tennessee used to, and UConn used to, and different things like that. And now you're taking a look at what Dawn Staley's doing at South Carolina and that she does there. And, the other USC and California is now starting to get rolling there too. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Mm-hmm. Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Tony, you want to talk NBA draft lottery or NBA playoffs next?
Let's go playoffs.
Okay. Playoffs.
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 With Jim Mora.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those things with the playoffs, Marty. I mean, I was there with the shovel putting the dirt on the Nuggets, and then all of a sudden they pulled an Undertaker and it came back out again. And I would say right now, I mean, I know Anthony Edwards might deny this, but I feel like the Nuggets are in control. I think it probably still goes seven games, but incredible by the Nuggets. And then, like you talked about last week, the Celtics are super talented but seem to have a brain fart game two or game three. I think it's been game two so far with both their series. And they had one against Cleveland again. And then tonight, Cleveland's without two starters, and it's a 10-point game at the end of the third. And so the Celtics, just kind of the consistent thing about the Celtics are they're consistently inconsistent. Mm-hmm. And then if Dallas wins tonight, OKC's in a lot of trouble, obviously being down 3-1. And so you take a look at that one. And then, you know, the Knicks and the Pacers just seem like a battle of attrition. And outside of some very interesting calls in the first two games of that series, Indiana could be up easily 3-1 or could have won in a sweep already. So I look at Indiana, if OG Anunoby and some of their guys don't start to come back off the injured list, I see Indiana going through. But at the same time, they're pretty dinged up with Halliburton and some of their stars.
Yeah. Let's kind of tick through them one at a time. Let's talk about the Nuggets Wolves. You're right. I think there was a lot of people putting dirt on them. I didn't see this. And Greg, I think they shot like 67% last night against Minnesota. We were watching. We were kind of flipping back and forth between some shows, and we watched the last minute of the first half as a family. Like, we were just sitting there, and Denver had the ball, and I think KCP, they were up seven. KCP hits the three with like 20 seconds left, and then Denver forces the turnover, and Jokic kicks it out to Porter for the dunk. So now they're up. Oh gosh, now there's math involved. 12, and then, you know, there's only 2 seconds left, and then Murray gets that ball and he throws it off the 1 foot, and right when it's in midair, I go, I think that might go, and went right through. I'm like, oh my god! You know, my family's like, oh geez, that's how do you know? I'm like, I didn't know. It just looked like it might go. So anyway, I think that, as Rudy T used to say, never underestimate the heart of a champion, and. You know, Jokic gives you the vibe of, I don't care, I'm just this big Serbian guy that likes horses. No, you don't get that good without really caring and being really, really competitive. And, you know, we should have known better that, you know, these guys are NBA champions and they're not going to go out, especially if they're healthy. You know, Mike Malone is a really prideful guy. He's not afraid to call his guys out, which I think is awesome. And what's even better is his players take it, or they look at him and go, yeah, you're right. You know what? We didn't bring it. We were soft. We didn't do this, you know, whatever it may be. So, it's a best of three. Who you got in the last three, Tony? I mean, who are you going to ride the Nuggets momentum here, or what do you think?
I think it's going seven. I'm going Denver. Malone, the adjustments that they've made, because they came in and I thought Minnesota had a great defensive game plan in. I mean, Jade McDaniels was all up in Murray. They had Gobert being able to play that free safety position. And then they began to do some things that put Minnesota in some very precarious situations, and they're shooting a very, very high percentage. You know, game four the other night, they made shots they normally don't make. I thought a lot of them were contested really, really well. But it goes back that you cannot have brain farts against them. And like you mentioned, those last 20 seconds or whatever of the half, that cost Minnesota the ball game.
Yeah.
You know, it was huge. And so the thing I would give you, I really think Jamal Murray had lost his poise. And I didn't think he should be suspended for a game. You know, when you take a look, he threw a towel. It didn't get to the floor. He threw the heat pack thing. That could have been dangerous. But at most, that was a technical foul. It was, I don't think it was a suspension worthy, and people have been talking, oh, he should have been suspended a game. It's the NBA playoffs. It's going to take a lot to get suspended for a game.
Yeah.
And so anyway, he has really stepped up his play. Those days off helped him, and he's played really, really well. The one thing I would be careful with if I were him, you know, again, Anthony Edwards is really, really good. Obviously, another 40-point game last night.
But he just needs some help. Often,
yeah, they've been talking some major stuff back and forth. But he needs some help, whether it's Karl Anthony Towns, who I felt terrible for. He wouldn't have hit water last night if he had fallen out of a boat in the first half. But they need a second score, whoever it may be. And it's probably Kat, maybe Jaden McDaniels. They need somebody to be in the 20s because he can't be expected to score mid 40s every night.
Well, and that brings us to our next series, Knicks and Pacers. Like you said, Tony, it very easily could be 3-1, or even it could be over. The Pacers are just running the Knicks off the floor. It looks like the Knicks are just. And you can't blame him, you know, and everybody's going to say, well, it's Tibbs running his guys into the ground. Yeah, and he could probably get some guys, you know, in there a little bit more, but he's down Bogdanovich. He's been down Randall for a long time. Now Mitchell Robinson is hurt. And there's only so many dudes that you can put out there at the same time, you know. So, but it just looks like, and especially with the way the Pacers play at the pace that they play at, that it's just, I think New York is just going to have a hard time bouncing back from this. I just think it's just a simple math equation that I just think the Pacers are going to have too much for them, whether it's in 6 or 7. I think the Pacers are going to end up winning this, Tony.
I would agree with that. You know, and the crazy thing for both teams, you know, Benedict Mathurin is out for the season for the Pacers. I mean, that's a pretty good piece for them. And then a guy that I think a lot of people have overlooked, Bogdanovich, is out for the season for the Knicks as well. And that's another guy that would have been very, very nice to have. And you can say what you want about Tibbs. You know, Jordan played 82 games every year, it seemed like. And, you know, I don't know. Could he do a little bit more with his rotation? Yes. But you're probably talking splitting hairs here and there. Like Alec Burks, I really respect him a lot. He's played really, really well for New York off the bench the past couple of games. You'll probably see some of his minutes go up. But if Jalen Brunson, I mean, he had scored, what, 40 points in a row, 4 games, first guy since Jordan to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just a thing where they're dead tired. They don't have a lot. They're going into a gunfight with a knife. And for them to do what they did the first 2 games has been super impressive. But OG Anunoby doesn't come out and play, they're cooked.
Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I agree with you. So, Celtics, Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde, Tony?
Tonight, they look like they're kind of okay. They're up 13 with about 8.5 to go here in the fourth.
Yep.
That'll put them up 3-1, and that basically will be checkmate. And then they'll get a banged-up team in the Eastern Conference Finals. And I like Boston's ability to make it to the Finals. I just don't know if they've played good enough competition or played consistently enough to win a title. But they, in my opinion, probably from top to bottom with that roster, I'm not saying starting five, but top to bottom of that roster, I think they're the most talented team left, but I don't think they're going to win the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, they're just – and the three-point variance is what it is. But yeah, it's just sometimes you look at them and you're like, why are you just – you know, it's kind of like Michael Scott talking to Toby Flenderson. Why are you the way that you are? Like, and you shouldn't say, it's almost like they're so, when they're good, they're so good. And it's almost like you take it for granted that, oh man, they are as good as they are at times. And again, like you said, they are definitely playing in the lesser of two conferences. They kick the snot out of a really beat up Miami team. They're in position to go back to Boston 3-1 on kind of a beat up Cleveland team with Donovan Mitchell out tonight, but then they putz around and they lose game two in both of these series, kind of like we just rather make this a little bit harder on ourselves instead of just taking care of business. Now, again, you know, like, and a lot of it comes from the defensive focus. Not, and now, the other night against Cleveland, they shot it really, really bad, which, again, that's the variance of the three-point shot, but it's the defensive lapses, and especially at this time of year, that's something that you shouldn't see, and I think that's what's really frustrating for Celtics fans.
Yes, because they're good enough that if they could lock in, they should destroy. I mean, it's one of the easier paths to the finals that I've ever seen a team have, is they've come across teams that are just beat up. I mean, if you had told me that, you know, Jared Allen, this will be game four, hasn't played, and then Donovan Mitchell's out, I'm surprised, to be honest with you, that the Cavs are within 13 right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's Oklahoma City and Dallas. Are we destined to go seven here, Tony? I think Oklahoma City is going to bounce back here tonight. I think Luka, kind of like a Jalen Brunson thing, he's at some point his knee is, he's got good days and bad days, and obviously the longer it goes, it can go one of two ways, that he's going to get healthier or it's going to continue to get beat up. You know, it's one or the other. So I really think Oklahoma City is going to bounce back tonight. Obviously, folks won't hear this until Friday, but I really think this one might be destined to go seven as well.
It seems like it is, but at the same time, I'll say this. I think Kyrie has been the best player on the floor for either team. It seems like his passing and his defense, which haven't always been his strong suit, are at a whole nother level. And then Luka, you know, I give him credit because he's out there basically on a leg and a half.
Yep.
And he's making some really, really good passes. The thing that I would give you with him is his passing has led to PJ Washington getting some wide open looks, and PJ Washington has had a great series, and he's been the difference. The difference between the two teams is this: like, Shea needs some help and he's not getting much help. And I feel like PJ Washington has become that third guy they can count on for Dallas. And if Dallas wins tonight, I could see this thing being done in five or six. I wouldn't say it's a must win, but it's about as close as a must win that's there for Oklahoma City. But Oklahoma City did have their chances in game three. So maybe they'll get her done tonight, but they've got to have somebody step up and help Gilgeous Alexander, or they're going to be done. And I'm wondering, you know, who that's going to be, whether that's Chet or, you know, maybe he could step up. He's more of a rebounder and a shot blocker than really a scorer, but they do need a second, and a third guy would really be beneficial for them.
Yeah. Yeah, they need that depth to pay off here. You know, they need that to happen for them. Like you said, it's kind of been the renaissance of Kyrie Irving. I mean, he's kind of, I don't know, matured, I guess, and mm-hmm. and just handling his business the way that he's supposed to, you know. So yeah, we'll see tonight. And tonight's going to be a really big game. If it goes 3-1, it's going to be tough for Oklahoma City. It's been done before, but it's going to be tough. And I don't think it's a must win, but boy, it would be a really, really, really convenient win if Oklahoma City can get this one here tonight. So,
They need Jalen Williams to be closer to his 20 a game regular season average than what he's been.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. So, last thing here, Tony, let's just talk draft lottery here for a couple of minutes. Atlanta gets the number one pick in true Atlanta Hawks fashion. They get the number one pick for the first time in, I want to say, 50 years, I thought I heard. And it might be what some people consider to be the worst draft in like 50 years.
Modern history, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so I was listening to, I believe it was Bill Simmons and Ryan Russillo, and they said this year, whoever the number one pick is this year, last year they probably would have been 10th or 11th in that draft, somewhere around there. So,
and it seems like it's more like they'll go overseas to probably be some of the top picks there.
Yeah,
I think you might
have as many as like five of the first eight, or six of the first nine might be overseas players.
Yeah, and so I think you'll see that. You could see, and the thing that'll be interesting is it is a bad draft. And I think you might see people make some trades they later on regret. Mm-hmm. And as they make these trades to get what I consider to be bad rookies, to get some veterans. That might be how Atlanta plays it off a little bit. But I've heard, you know, they want to move Trae Young too. So who knows? It could be a very, very important point in time for the Atlanta Hawk franchise, you know, depending upon what they do with it. What are they going to do with Trae Young? There's a variety of things that will be interesting to see going forward with this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel bad for Detroit. You know, they had the best odds to get the first pick and they ended up with the fifth pick. And like we've already talked about, it's a bad draft. And you know, it'll be interesting. You know, there's some interesting players out there. You know, I like Rob Dillingham from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. That's a very intriguing pick for me there. But yeah, this is probably one of the lowest amount of players that I've known going into this draft.
Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued. I've seen a little bit on this Sar kid, you know, and I mean, he's 6'11 with a 7'4 wingspan, you know, interesting, you know, clinging, you know, space eater, shot blocker, that type of thing. You know, it'll be interesting to see. I'm really intrigued by the Spurs, like I wrote on the sheet, Tony. You know, two picks in the top eight here. Can they get complementary pieces to go around Wimby? And I think that's what, if you're Atlanta, you're looking for maybe a bit of a reboot. You're stuck in basketball purgatory here. So we've got Quinn Snyder, who's a terrific coach. Let's, for example, trade Trae Young. Let's get as much back as we can. Hopefully somebody will pay $1.25 on the dollar for him. And mm-hmm. and then we get a good young player that we could give 2 or 3 years to develop here in Atlanta. DeJounte Murray is not exactly old. And, you know, Clint Capella, we can move him along and just, you know, reboot and have, you know, maybe this kid is the number one pick, but he's your third best player, but he's going to be a really solid third best player, and he's not going to be the superstar that you want. And you just got to kind of play the hand that you're dealt, because you also don't want to trade it out for 60 cents on the dollar either. If you're anybody with any of these high picks either.
You know, and the one thing I always kind of wanted back a little bit with the Spurs, you know, obviously they had Derek White, they had Murray that's on the Hawks now. I mean, those are two really good players that if you could plug them in around Wemby, holy cow. And yeah. So I think that might be what the Spurs do, is they realize, hey, it's not a great draft. Let's package some stuff and see if we can get not other rookies around Wemby. Let's get some veterans and some guys, kind of like what Houston did, where they went out and got Van Vliet and Dylan Brooks, and they got some veterans. They got some adults in the room. Mm-hmm. That might help fast forward that San Antonio rebuild a little bit quicker.
Yeah. Well, you know what Popovich might say to all this, Tony?
What's that?
Throw me a freaking bone here.
Sorry, I'm on an Austin Powers kick.
You are an Austin Powers kick tonight.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, that would be something. And I think that would really help. Like, the West is so loaded. Yeah. I mean, you got some teams in there, you know, Golden State obviously didn't get in the playoffs. They got in the play-in and stuff like that. But you have to know Houston's ready to make another jump. San Antonio could be making a jump. There's some teams out there. Ja's going to be back with Memphis. Are they going to be – the West is going to be a dog-eat-dog world out there.
Yep. Tony, episode number 86, mid-range game, sharing the ball. Reps, 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 and celebrate it, celebrate it, celebrate it. That's my piece of advice for both of these skills.
Let's just go with ditto.
Yeah, yeah, good stuff there. So episode 86, Tony, great stuff here this week. Coaches, I hope you've enjoyed it. You know, hopefully, you know, we're good with this, and you've enjoyed the Austin Powers sharks with lasers, you know, type of a thing here. Throw me a friggin' bone, all right? Yeah, it's been a great week. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.